Hechel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson. This is recording number 94 in the series entitled Confronting the Darkness. If you encounter mud in your heart, you're doing well. This class was recorded live at Hechel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York, on the 12th of Adar 2, 5760.
Good evening. In the beginning of the 36th chapter of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe discussed the purpose, the ultimate objective and goal of existence. He began by stating and explaining the idea that in order for us to exist, Hashem had to conceal His own existence. To allow us to emerge as human beings with identities, that process necessitated Hashem to conceal His own existence. Because the cardinal law of life is, as mentioned last week, that when you have something of the size of 100 cubic feet filling a space of 100 cubic feet, it occupies the entire space and nothing else can enter and occupy that space. If you have something that fills, that is infinite in size, so then nothing can occupy any space at any given time. Hashem permeates and transcends existence as we know it, but also permeates the entire expanse of our existence. And thus, essentially, the only reality is godliness. This does not mean that creation is an illusion, that we don't exist. It just means we don't exist outside of His reality. There is no independent reality outside of His all-pervading presence and existence. We are an aspect of the Creator. So there is nothing outside of Him. And even within Him there are no two existences. It's an aspect that has no name and identity in the presence of His intimate, all-pervading reality. But if that were to be revealed, then obviously there would be no concept of identity, of creation, of a world. The truth is that His reality was the only reality and is the only reality. To allow for our existence, He had to conceal His existence. That concealment exists on many levels, each level consisting of another world, depending on the nature and the magnitude of the concealment. The more the concealment and the obscurity of his reality, the more the emergence of a sense of autonomy and independence and self-orientation. But even the highest and deepest worlds, even the highest, most spiritual worlds that are egoless and define themselves only in terms of being emanations or projections of their creator and so forth, even they are affected by what we call the tzimtzum, the process of concealment. Because if nothing would be concealed, there would be no ability for anything to emerge, even an egoless identity, even a spiritual identity. This is what's known as the tzimtzum, which is, according to the Ariza, the vacuum, so to speak, that Hashem formed within His infinite presence, allowing for the identity of creation to emerge. And as Chassidus, as the Alter Rebbe explains, and explained here, what this concealment means is not that Hashem removed His being from that vacuum, from that space, but rather He concealed His presence and allowed a perception of autonomy, a perception of a world that exists outside of Himself. Without any tzimtzum whatsoever, there would be nothing besides Him, because that is the truth, that there is nothing besides Him. Again, there are many rungs in this concealment, many levels, many gradations, and thus many worlds evolving one from another. The greater the veil, the more dense the curtain, and the more thick the wall, the more separate, remote, and distant is the consciousness that characterizes the creatures inhabiting those specific worlds. Until we finally reach our world. And our physical world is a world where he says that the tzimtzum, the concealment, has become the most powerful and the most dense that is conceivable. And here lay the uniqueness of this world. In all of the other worlds, what defines their existence? They're all defined by the fact that they're godly. They express godliness, they gravitate to godliness, and so forth. It's just the tzimtzum plays a role in their identities in the sense that it dilutes the intensity of the all-inclusiveness of godliness, the truth of His all-pervading reality. It compromises it somewhat. It contracts it. It limits it. So thus, there can be an emergence of a world who feels Hashem, who seeks Hashem, who gravitates to Hashem, and so forth. What happens in our world is something of totally another nature. The tzimtzum defines our existence. What is the definition of our world as perceived by the inhabitants of this world? Self-centeredness and self-orientation and self-aggrandizement. In the higher world, the tzimtzum plays a role in compromising the energy of godliness. But what is the definition of the world? They're a godly world. And here the tzimtzum takes over exclusively. When you gaze at the world, we'll soon walk out of this room and walk on the sidewalk. Gaze at the sidewalk that you'll be treading on. What is the rock declaring? If there would be no concealment, the rock would declare, I am nothing but an aspect of my Creator expressing His all-pervading reality. If there would really be no concealment, no, Zaks Nishgut. Hashem created the world on all levels. Even its identity as an aspect of the Creator would not be conspicuous. It would be submerged in the intimacy of Hashem, and thus have no name, presence, significance whatsoever. There is such a powerful concealment. You don't feel the latter idea. You don't feel the former idea. The rock says, I am. And so does your dishwasher, and so does your couch, and so does your bedroom, and so does your body, and so does our whole identity. This is what defines our life. Concealment is what gives the physical world its identity. Atzilus, Bria, Yetzirah, the higher spiritual worlds, as they're called, their identity is not darkness, their identity is godliness. It's just, it's diluted, it's compromised, it's contracted, and so forth. Here, what is the definition of the identity of the world? It's a world where godliness is concealed. It does not bespeak its creator in any form or fashion. So the concealment of his existence that takes place in our world is the most powerful that's possible. And thus it's called the Tachtonim, the lower elements where he's absolutely unknown, to the extent that you can walk around your whole life and remain an agnostic, become an atheist, and combat any idea or perception of a creator and so forth. Zogd Alter Rebbe, in the name of the Medrash, that here in this world lay the purpose of creation, the objective, the goal, and the theme of all creation and existence lay in the creation of this world, that Hashem desired to have a residence, a dwelling place, a home below, betachtainim, in these lower elements. The higher worlds, as great and awesome and spiritual as they are, they don't constitute the ultimate purpose, because in fact they constitute a descent and a compromise. In their previous state, pre-creation, they were on a much more real level, on a much more lofty level, on a much more in a much more sublime state. So the purpose is not exist in the higher worlds. Where lay the purpose of creation? In this mundane, earthly world, characterized by darkness. Here is the purpose why Hashem created everything. He wanted that a human being and a Jew should enter into this space, a space which bespeaks nothing of spirituality, where the Tzimtzum defines its entire existence, because that is the definition of physicality, which is our world, physical time, space, objects, and so forth. And should redefine it and reform it from a world that's inhospitable, absolutely inhospitable to its essence, to fashion it into a home that will become an expression of his essential manifest presence. And here lay the true objective of all of the worlds, and of all creation, not in the spirituality of the higher worlds. Again, that's a descent. On the contrary, in this world where there is nothing and the whole world is defined by the darkness, a Jew should come and introduce the godly essence and the true nature of reality into this physical world. It doesn't bespeak anything. And then he said that the illumination that we can experience here will transcend infinitely even the illumination that characterizes all the higher worlds, because in them, their illumination is affected by garments and veils and so forth. Versus here, there is the ability that the essence of Hashem should be revealed without any garments. It will become clear. according to Chassidus, the flood in Noach's times is described as a result of what we can call a cosmic indigestion. The immune system can contain a certain amount of unhealthy foods, and then finally the day comes, it just vomits. It was too alienated. It was being too alienated from itself. And here, I want to share with you something that Alter Rebbe writes elsewhere. There's a sefer known as Maimari Admir Azakin as Halach Lajna, which include discourses that Alter Rebbe said in the earlier years when he lived in Lajna, pretty brief and concise discourses. And in one of the first discourses, he discusses a concept that echoes what Alter Rebbe writes here in Tanya with an interesting example. He discusses the nature of our prayer, of our davening. He says, when a Jew stands up to daven, is it really worth anything? We know what happens to us during prayer. We are basically, it's very moving how the Alter Rebbe tailors himself to ordinary people in that discourse. He says, you stand up to daven. In the middle of davening, every type of alien thought enters our mind. Even if for a moment we become inspired towards spirituality, it's coupled and it's followed by other instincts, impulses, cravings, and drives, and so forth. Even when we feel sometimes inspired, optimistic, spiritual, and we stand up to serve Hashem, he says the davening itself is schlepped down by a body, by an animal soul, by all types of confusing ideas that may enter into our mind. And that's the story of our life. So the Alter Rebbe gives an example. He gives his example that I'll soon share with you, but I want to modernize the example. He gives an example of rear food, of a place where food is rear there. Take, for example, airline food that's served on a plane. Did you ever see people sitting on a plane, how they react when the food comes? They're very excited. They're very excited. They slowly take out the fork and the knife and so forth, and continue devouring the food. They are so hungry that this food becomes a very precious delicacy that's extremely satisfying. And if you ordered your kosher food and it's not there, it can be extremely frustrating and resentful and frustrating and make you angry and hungry and cranky and so forth. Imagine, you'll come home this evening and your wife will serve you that same food that they serve you on the airplane. She'll serve it to you for dinner. What would you do? If everybody knows, the rice that they food on airplanes are usually celebrating their bar mitzvah. The green beans are not too much better, and so on and so forth. It's the lowest of the lowest quality. The LMI, when you're on an airplane, you're vulnerable. You're not in the presence of your refrigerator or cafeteria across the street. And when you don't have anything else, that becomes the most delicious meal you can conceive. In your home, in the presence of so many delicacies and so many opportunities, you wouldn't even look at it. You'll immediately throw it into the garbage and so forth. The Alter Rebbe uses the same example in his relative to his era, and says, when you're in your own home and in your own mansion or palace, even the most delicious foods are not really significant. When you come into a desert and you have nothing, someone can offer you a piece of hard bread and a half a cup of water, and it becomes the most delicious, exquisite, powerful, tasty meal that you have ever tasted in your life. There's an old Jewish story about a king who was lost in a forest and went around days without food or drinks, and then he came to a hut, and an old man, very poverty-stricken individual, presented to him some hard bread and a little drink and so forth, and showed him the way back. And then the king invited him to the palace and rewarded him with an awesome amount of diamonds and gold and silver. So he says, what are you rewarding me for? He says, for the meal you gave me. He says, the meal, it was nothing. It was a piece of bread and a cup of water. So the king said, I want to tell you that hard piece of bread and that cup of water was the most delicious, expensive meal I've ever enjoyed in my whole life. Because it really depends on circumstances and on the location where you're present. In the spiritual world, Hashem is, so to speak, in his own atmosphere. There's an atmosphere of spirituality there. So the most delicious meals, you have the myriads of angels screaming, Kaddish, Kaddish, Kaddish. There's no egos there, there's no corruptions, there's no lie, there's no deceits, there's no cover-ups. There's no ego, there's no self-centeredness there. That's what defines the spiritual worlds. So he says, the greatest, most awesome, powerful meals are ultimately insignificant. In the terminology of the Tanya, the deepest worlds are an aspect of his creation, of the aspect of the Creator, an aspect that's insignificant relative to his intimate presence. In this world, conversely, Hashem is absolutely unknown. It's a tachten she'ein tachten lamata himenu. Godliness, spirituality, holiness, transcendence is a novelty. It's absolutely uncommon and not to be found. It's a world that's characterized by self-centeredness, selfishness, self-aggrandizement, and everything evolves around the self and the autonomous, egotistical components of the human identities, of the human identity and so forth. So the little inspiration that a Yid experiences when he gets up to Davin, that fleeting spark of spiritual excitement, although relative to what is happening in the higher world, is absolutely hollow, almost meaningless. It's a joke. But since you're on an airplane, so that decayed and rotten food becomes the most precious item for your body and the most tasty meal you might have had in years. And this is the nature of our life in the physical world. Since it is a tachtin, it's defined exclusively in terms of tzimtzum, what gives Hashem the ultimate pleasure and the purpose of the whole creation was, not the spiritual worlds, that a Yid and a human being should come into this world where there's no inspiration, there's no spirituality, there's no revelation of godliness, there's no expression of anything higher whatsoever. These concepts are absolutely superimposed to our ordinary perception of reality. Chapter after chapter. Again, you can walk around 80, 90, 100 years and won't even cross your mind once any of the ideas Alter Rebbe is talking to you about. Even though from his perception, that's the only truth. So we come into this world, and what do we deal with? What do we have to deal with? We have to deal with our physical bodies, our physical worlds, our physical selves. Where there's nothing, there's no glimmer, no ray, no expression, no revelation whatsoever. It's here that a Yid should make from this a dir b'tachtonim. True, you might say that this inspiration relative to the higher world is meaningless. Here lay the deepest connection, the deepest preciousness. This is what Hashem values more than anything else. Kadiskafya, as he put it. Kadiskafya sitra achre vis hapach sheichel naira. When sitra achre is suppressed and transformed, you come into a world and you have to deal with your cravings and impulses and problems that don't bespeak spirituality whatsoever. What is a craving? When you have a craving to do something healthy, what is that? That's a real product of the tzimtzum. The tzimtzum is so powerful, not only can an ego emerge, but a totally ridiculous, unhealthy impulse can emerge in a very powerful way that people follow daily. When you come to your craving and you say no, what are you doing? You're making a dira b'tachtonim. You're telling the taiva that the tzimtzum is not emes, and I will not fall prey to you. Now, this level of spirituality is minute relative to the higher levels of spirituality. It's extremely entangled. It's burdensome. It's coupled with constant struggle and falling back and trials and tribulations and ups and downs and moods and so forth. But here lay the dira b'tachteinim. In the tachtin to make a dira, to make that a home where Hashem is present to bring in godliness into our life, into the physical world, into our physical space, here lay the objective of the whole creation. You can put it thus. Hashem had to conceal His existence to allow our existence. So conversely, we have to conceal our existence to allow for His existence. This is what we call in Hasidic terminology flipping the tzimtzum. Flipping the tzimtzum means the original tzimtzum was the concealment of His presence to allow for our presence. Flipping the tzimtzum means the concealment of our presence, the transcendence beyond the self, the letting go of the ego, to allow the reemergence of His presence. Where did He want the flip of the tzimtzum should happen? In tachtainim. And that constitutes the life of a Jew in our world, filled with darkness and negativity and unholiness. To deal with that and make that a dira, here lay the goal of everything.
What's the challenge of a guy on a similar look at
the he'll discuss it at the end of the chapter. The role of the nations in this. It's a similar role.
Even though you say that this is the purpose of all creation, it doesn't exclude the possibility that all those other worlds have a specific function and accomplish certain things once they are created.
All the higher worlds were created to yield our world, and they assist us in making a dira b'tachteinim in our world. They are a template for us, a paradigm of spirituality for us. As a preparation, an introduction, an instrument for our world. What is the purpose of existence? That's the question. What constitutes the purpose of existence?
Well,
Alter Rebbe says in the name of the Medrash that this is the ultimate purpose of existence. Nesava Kadosh Baruch Hu liyis le'dira b'tachteinim. Hayil v'lehem yirida. They constitute a yirida, the Olam HaSalyan. They are Yirida. What did Hashem desire? He desired the Berach of Gashmias. Entering into physical space with his total concealment, take that concealment and make that into a dira.
I heard a story this way.
You have somebody who's a servant of the king. You know? But in addition to being servant of the king, he has a wife, he has children, he has cousins, he has other functions as well. Maybe his main function is being a servant of the king.
So Zainal, and there was, what are you getting at? No.
I mean, is it necessary to say that all the other worlds are in God's bubble and have no purpose at all except as a function of sustaining this world or leading towards this world?
It's not just they don't only sustain the world. They yield this world, and they serve as a template to this world, and allowing us to elevate this world and so forth. But here lay the ultimate purpose, according to the Alter Rebbe. The Alshich was a student of the Arizal. Once the Alshich was giving a shiur Shabbos Parshas Chayisara in Shul, and Arizal himself came to attend the class. The shiur was on the first section of Chayisara, dealing with Sarah's passing, and Avraham determined to purchase the cave of Machpelah in Chevron as a place to bury his wife. And his encounter with Ephraim, the leader of the Chittites, who sold him the Maris HaMachpelah for 400 silver shekels. And the Alshich discussed it from his perspective. In the middle of the shiur, Darizal stands up and leaves the room. It disturbed and perturbed the Alshich very deeply. Darizal himself, you can imagine, in the middle of the class, stood up and left. It destroyed him. He had to finish the class because the crowd was there was a large crowd there, but his heart was not present. So, following the class, he went to Darizal. He said, "Reb, why did I deserve such a treatment? Why did you leave?" Darizal said, "I'll tell you the truth. You gave a class on the issues discussed in the beginning of Chayisara. So obviously, who came to your class? In addition to all the people present, the soul of Avraham came, the soul of Sarah came, and the soul of Ephron came. In the middle of the class, you started to feel good about yourself. You felt a little good. So Avraham and Sarah left the class. Who remained? Ephron. I didn't want to remain there alone with Ephron, so I also left. This is the definition of egotism perspective of Chassidus. Why did Avraham and Sarah leave? Because where the ego is in, God is out. Because to allow for the ego, God had to go out. At least allow for a perception that he's out. From his perspective, there's no difference. He had to conceal his existence. That allows for the sense of self, because there's no real sense of self. There's only one reality. Detaching from Hashem means detaching from reality. Hu levadei hu memalei kol hamakom hazeh. Nothing else ever happened. So the real thing is a conduit. You let go of everything. Just let go. Avraham and Sarah need godliness. They're allergic to untruth. They left Ephron stayed. They couldn't wipe him at Ephron. The Hilchos Rishonim, the Bistal Rishonim, used to come to a specific city, and he'd always stay at someone's home. In that city, there were two wealthy Jews who had large homes. One Jew was a Torah scholar, a very pious man, a very religious man, but extremely arrogant. His ego was so inflated that it was very difficult for him to get along with people. The other Jew was much more humble. But the thing with him was is that there were rumors about him that he's not meticulous in his observance of mitzvahs. And the Rujuna would always stay at his home. And the other Jew ones came to him and said, Rabbi, I don't understand you. About that Jew, there are rumors that he's not meticulous in his observance. And he's not cautious in the mitzvahs and so forth. I'm known as a very frum yid. Why are you rejecting my hospitality time after time again? And the Rujuna responded, he said, I'll tell you the truth. The Pasuk says, Hashoichin itam b'seich tumasam. Hashem dwells with them in the midst of their impurity. Zagin, our sages say that even when they're tamei, they're impure, the Shekhinah is there. But then the Gemara says, in Saita concerning an arrogant individual, that Hashem says, Ein aniva hu yecheilin ladur b'kveches kevachas, you and he and I cannot live under the same roof. So he says, I'll tell you the truth. I'm most comfortable in a home where Hashem is somewhat present there. So Tuma, Hashem can still tolerate, but Gaivi can't tolerate. Why? Because the ego is like the ego is the most powerful declaration that Hashem is out. Now, where does this ego exist in the most powerful way? In our world. Even the highest worlds also have somewhat of an ego, but you can't really call it an ego. It's a tiny, tiny ego. It's an identity more. It's self-awareness more than an ego. But this world is defined by ego. That's the definition of it. You come into the world, what's your definition? What's my definition? I have needs. I have an identity. I'm angry. I'm resentful. I'm complaining. I'm upset. I'm depressed. I'm happy. That's the definition. Definition of people, it's the definition of physical objects, that's the definition of the world. So here the concealment has reached its peak. Its powerful level. Zagdal to Rebbe, what's the whole purpose of existence? To come into this world and make a dira bitachtoin, and make here a dira. Yeah, let's continue, yeah? If you do something good, can I feel I did something good? Of course. I hope you do. How do you know if the good feeling is coming from an ego place or it's coming from a divine place? There's very often, usually there's a mixture of the two. I think the greatest barometer to be aware of that is if the moment after you do that, when you're feeling good about yourself, someone tells you something that your ego dislikes, what the response is. Someone does something that challenges our ego. What are responses? If you're blown away and you're really overtaken by anger, it's because your ego just became much bigger. But if you were a conduit, and thus it was a soul type of good, so your ego became smaller through that. So you're more chilled, you're more in touch with the real energy, you're more capable of real relationships and love and so forth. You understand what I'm saying? Now, the mixture is very common. And the way to deal with the mixture is not to eliminate it, but just to be aware of it and not to take the ego. You see, we have egos. The question is how serious we are to take them. The Alter Rebbe says, don't take your ego that seriously, because you don't want to take something that doesn't exist too seriously. You don't want to. It doesn't pay. It doesn't pay to invest your whole energy in it when it's not happening. It's groundless, yeah?
There's an easier test, which is if you get a compliment, if you accept it, if you've encabled a compliment and go with it, that's also a test. You should want to reject the compliment as much as possible. And on that note, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I happened to notice last week a sign in Crown Heights, which advertised you, and underneath it said your name. It said a noted lecturer, famous lecturer, or something, noted lecturer and author. I didn't know you wrote books, but the point is that why wouldn't you want to delete that? Just say Yossi Jacobson, and hey, people know you for a nice guy. You know, wouldn't have to know what you did. You know, I mean. Noted author and lecturer. I mean, that ruined the whole thing. Your name was good. You know, and then when I saw noted author and lecturer, I said, well, this guy teaches Tanya, and this doesn't
the guy's in the future.
And there's not enough good said about people. So if somebody says something good about
thank you.
Them,
yeah.
He didn't know.
A friend of mine, he does says, and he even says, you don't care what people compliment you, you don't care what people tell you, it's all irrelevant.
Yeah.
Is it a compliment from someone, a compliment from a very close school, a compliment from yourself, is just between ego?
That's a way of putting it.
Respect is not given a negative emotion. If the symptoms are coming from a good mentor, then one tends to miss the very little that you want to
bring. Yeah, that's
much,
good.
Much anything, if it's coming from the guy, then you can become complacent.
That's good. If the joy is coming from the soul place, it motivates you to do another mitzvah, to become more spiritual. If it's coming from the ego, you'll become complacent with it. That's a good point. Yeah?
Yeah, I just wanted to understand how is the mixture possible. You said in the Gemara that Hashem doesn't dwell in the place of ego. How does the mixture...
Because we have two souls. That's how the mixture is possible. Yeah? Let's continue, yeah? This was the theme of chapter 32, indeed. And that's the whole idea. Nesava Kadosh Baruch Hu is Lidira B'tachteinu, means coming into a world where there's a perception of self and making that into a dwelling place. So that is indeed a dichotomy. We come into a world that's characterized exclusively by a tzimtzum, and we flip it. Okay, now let's continue. We're on Daf Mem Vav Amud Aleph, six lines from the top. Since you mentioned what you mentioned, I'll share something with you, even though it's really disconnected to this chapter and to this class. I was invited to host a Shabbaton in Malibu, California a few weeks ago. And they call the shul there the shul with a view, because it's right on the ocean. So it's with a view on a physical level and also on a spiritual level. And there's a very powerful community of extremely spiritual human beings there. And it was a very challenging Shabbaton. Usually, in addressing Jews without a background and so forth, the spiritual teachings of Yiddishkeit have to be presented in a manner that's relevant to them. But here, most of them are so developed in their spiritual journeys and so forth that I had the ability of just teaching and communicating to the best of my ability undiluted chassidus, and it went straight in. Friday night, following my speech during the Shabbos meal, a Jew came over to me and started to talk with me. And the conversation I thought initially will last for 5 minutes, but it went for 3 hours. Now, this Jew puts on 4 pairs of tefillin every day. 4 pairs of tefillin. Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam, Shemusha Rabba, and Ravit. And when I asked him, why do you put on 4 pairs of tefillin? Because I never met anyone that puts on. I mean, the Rebbe would put on 4 pairs of tefillin. And the Rebbe himself said that he was frightened to do it until his father-in-law, the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, commanded him to do so. So I asked this Jew, why do you put on 4 pairs of tefillin? He says, what do you mean? to get connected. He says Rashi is Bina, and then Rabbi Natan is Chachma, but I need Arich and Atik. I need the real thing. Shmusha Rabbah is Arich, and I arrive at this Atik over the two levels of Keser, the superconscious elements of the soul. He says, to be connected, get connected. He says, Rabbi Jacobson, do it, start doing it someday. You'll get connected.
California.
You'll get connected.
Why am I?
He says, you have to put on four pairs to get connected. Now, then he told me the following words that were very meaningful to me. And admittingly, it wasn't easy to hear in the beginning, but it was very meaningful. This is what he said. He said, Jacobson, you don't get it. You don't get it. You can't get it. You can't. How could you get it? You're self-conscious. And when you're self-conscious, you can't get it. He says, when you get up to speak, you somewhere are thinking about your reputation and if people will like you or dislike you and what type of effect you'll have on people. And if you even have a drop of that in your psyche when you're speaking, you're not a conduit for the real energy. Let go, even though it's scary, and become a conduit. There's no I. The I needs nothing. It doesn't exist. But in you it exists. How can you be a conduit? It gets stuck right in you. And in the beginning I said, what are you talking about? And he said, you teach Tanya, but this is the whole essence of Tanya and of Chassidus, and everything else is commentary. That to the extent that you're self-conscious, that's the extent to which you don't get it. And to the extent to which you're not self-conscious, that's the extent to which you get it. And that was a way of characterizing the message of all of these chapters in a sentence. That to the extent that you're self-conscious, you're not a conduit and you just don't get it. You're totally post-Simpson reality. Now he says, you're scared. You're scared because this is your career. And this is like jumping off a cliff. You're scared when you jump off the cliff, you'll die. The truth, when you'll jump off the cliff, you'll fly. And this is called in Chassidus, bittul. Bittul means jumping off the cliff. From the Alter Rebbe's perspective, you cannot begin living till you jump off the cliff. Because as long as you don't jump off the cliff, your life is defined by your own comfort zone and pattern. And when it's defined by your own pattern, you're stuck in the tzimtzum glue and entanglement where things are not, you're not aligned with reality.